Chapter 4. And then Joe, with the air of a Monte Cristo, drew forth a 10, a 5, a 2 and a 1 all legal tender notes, and laid them beside Delia's earnings. Sold that watercolor of the obelisk to a man from Peoria, he announced overwhelmingly. Don't joke with me, said Delia, not from Peoria. All the way. I wish you could see him, Deal. Fat man with a woolen muffler and a quill toothpick. He saw the sketch in Tinkle's window, and thought it was a windmill at first. He was game, though, and bought it anyhow. He ordered another an oil sketch of the Lackawanna Freight Depot to take back with him. Music lessons. Oh, I guess art is still in it. I'm so glad you've kept on, said Delia, heartily. We're bound to win, dear. $33. We never had so much to spend before. We'll have oysters tonight. And filet mignon with champignons, said Joe. Here's the olive fork. On the next Saturday evening, Joe reached home first. He spread his $18 on the parlor table and washed what seemed to be a great deal of dark paint from his hands. Half an hour later, Delia arrived, her right hand tied up in a shapeless bundle of wraps and bandages. How is this? Asked Joe after the usual greetings. Delia laughed, but not very joyously. Clementina, she explained, insisted upon a Welsh rabbit after her lesson. She is such a queer girl. Welsh rabbits at 5 in the afternoon. The general was there. You should have seen him run for the chafing dish, Joe, just as if there wasn't a servant in the house. I know Clementina isn't in good health. She is so nervous. In serving the rabbit, she spilled a great lot of it, boiling hot, over my hand and wrist. It hurt awfully, Joe. And the dear girl was so sorry. But Jen, Pinney, Joe, that old man nearly went distracted. He rushed downstairs and sent somebody, they said the furnace man, or somebody in the basement out to a drugstore for some oil and things to bind it up with. It doesn't hurt so much now. What's this? Asked Joe, taking the hand tenderly and pulling at some white strands beneath the bandages. It's something soft, said Delia, that had oil on it. Oh, Joe, did you sell another sketch? As he had seen the money on the table. Did I? Said Joe. Just ask the man from Peoria. He got his depot today, and he isn't sure, but he thinks he wants another parkscape and a view on the Hudson. What time this afternoon did you burn your hand, Deal? 5 o'clock, I think, said Deal, plaintively. The rabbit came off the fire about that time. You ought to have seen Jen. Pinney, Joe, when, sit down here a moment, Deal, said Joe. He drew her to the couch, sat beside her, and put his arm across her shoulders. What have you been doing for the last 2 weeks, Deal, he asked. She braved it for a moment or two with an eye full of love and stubbornness, and murmured a phrase or two vaguely of General Pinney, but at length down went her head, and out came the truth and tears. I couldn't get any pupils, she confessed. Andy, I couldn't bear to have you give up your lessons, and I got a place ironing shirts in that big 24th Street laundry. And I think I did very well, to make up both General Pinney and Clementina, don't you, Joe? And when a girl in the laundry set down a hot iron on my hand this afternoon, I was all the way home making up that story about the Welsh rabbit. You're not angry, are you, Joe? And if I hadn't got the work, you mightn't have sold your sketches to that man from Peoria. He wasn't from Peoria, said Joe, slowly. Well, it doesn't matter where he was from. How clever you are, Joanne, kiss me, Joanne, what made you ever suspect that I wasn't giving music lessons to Clementina? I didn't, said Joe, until tonight. And I wouldn't have then, only I sent up this cotton waste and oil from the engine room this afternoon for a girl upstairs who had her hand burned with a smoothing iron. I've been firing the engine in that laundry for the last 2 weeks. And then you didn't, my purchaser from Peoria, said Joe, and Jen. Pinney are both creations of the same art, but you wouldn't call it either painting or music. And then they both laughed, and Joe began. When one loves one's art, no service seems, but Delia stopped him with her hand on his lips. Oh, she said, just when one loves. Apostrophe. The coming out of Maggie, every Saturday night the Clover Leaf Social Club gave a hop in the hall of the Give and Take Athletic Association on the East Side. In order to attend one of these dances, you must be a member of the Give and Take, or, if you belong to the division that starts off with the right foot in waltzing, you must work in Rinnegold's paper box factory. Still, any Clover Leaf was privileged to escort or be escorted by an outsider to a single dance. But mostly each Give and Take brought the paper box girl that he affected, and few strangers could boast of having shaken a foot at the regular hops. Maggie Toole, on account of her dull eyes, broad mouth and left-handed style of footwork in the two-step, went to the dances with Anna McCarty and Torello. Anna and Maggie worked side by side in the factory, and were the greatest chums ever. So Anna always made Jimmy Burns take her by Maggie's house every Saturday night, so that her friend could go to the dance with them. The Give and Take Athletic Association lived up to its name. The hall of the association in Orchard Street was fitted out with muscle-making inventions. With the fibers thus builded up, the members were wont to engage the police and rival social and athletic organizations in joyous combat. Between these more serious occupations, the Saturday night hop with the paper box factory girls came as a refining influence and as an efficient screen. For sometimes the tip went round, and if you were among the elect that tiptoed up the dark back stairway, you might see as neat and satisfying a little welterweight affair to a finish as ever happened inside the ropes. On Saturdays, Rinnegold's paper box factory closed at 3 p.m. On one such afternoon, Anna and Maggie walked homeward together. At Maggie's door, Anna said, as usual, "E ready at 7, sharp, Mag. And Jimmy and me'll come by for you." But what was this? Instead of the customary humble and grateful thanks from the non-escorted one, there was to be perceived a high-poised head, a prideful dimpling at the corners of a broad mouth, and almost a sparkle in a dull brown eye. "Thanks, Anna," said Maggie, "but you and Jimmy needn't bother tonight. I've a gentleman friend that's coming round to escort me to the hop." The comely Anna pounced upon her friend, shook her, chided and beseeched her. "Maggie Toole, catch a fellow. Plain, dear, loyal, unattractive Maggie, so sweet as a chum, so unsought for a two-step or a moonlit bench in the little park. How was it? When did it happen? Who was it?" "You'll see tonight," said Maggie, flushed with the wine of the first grapes as he had gathered in Cupid's vineyard. "He's swell all right. He's 2 inches taller than Jimmy, and an up-to-date dresser. I'll introduce him, Anna, just as soon as we get to the hall." Anna and Jimmy were among the first Clover Leafs to arrive that evening. Anna's eyes were brightly fixed upon the door of the hall, to catch the first glimpse of her friend's hatch. At 8:30, Miss Toole swept into the hall with her escort. Quickly her triumphant eye discovered her chum under the wing of her faithful Jimmy. "Oh, gee," cried Anna, "Mag ain't made a hit, oh, no. Swell fellow? Well, I guess. Style? Look at 'em." "Go as far as you like," said Jimmy, with sandpaper in his voice. "Cop him out, if you want him. These new guys always win out with a push. Don't mind me. He don't squeeze all the limes, I guess. Huh. Shut up, Jimmy. You know what I mean. I'm glad for Mag. First fellow she ever had. Oh, here they come." Across the floor, Maggie sailed like a coquettish yacht convoyed by a stately cruiser. And truly, her companion justified the encomiums of the faithful chum. He stood 2 inches taller than the average give-and-take athlete. His dark hair curled, his eyes and his teeth flashed whenever he bestowed his frequent smiles. The young men of the Clover Leaf Club pinned not their faith to the graces of person as much as they did to its prowess, its achievements in hand-to-hand conflicts, and its preservation from the legal duress that constantly menaced it. The member of the association who would bind a paper box maiden to his conquering chariot scorned to employ bow brummeers. They were not considered honorable methods of warfare. The swelling biceps, the coat straining at its buttons over the chest, the air of conscious conviction of the supereminence of the male in the cosmogony of creation, even a calm display of Bolex as subduing and enchanting agents in the gentle tourneys of Cupid, these were the approved arms and ammunition of the cloverleaf gallants. They viewed, then, genuflections and alluring poses of this visitor with their chins at a new angle. A friend of mine, Mr. Terry O'Sullivan, was Maggie's formula of introduction. She led him around the room, presenting him to each new arriving clover leaf. Almost was she pretty now, with the unique luminosity in her eyes that comes to a girl with her first suitor, and a kitten with its first mouse. Maggie Tool's got a fellow at last, was the word that went round among the paper box girls. I Max Floorwalker thus the give and takes expressed their indifferent contempt. Usually at the weekly hops Maggie kept a spot on the wall warm with her back. She felt and showed so much gratitude whenever a self-sacrificing partner invited her to dance that his pleasure was cheapened and diminished. As he had even grown used to noticing Anna joggle the reluctant Jimmy with her elbow as a signal for him to invite her chum to walk over his feet through a two-step. But tonight the pumpkin had turned to a coach and six. Terry O'Sullivan was a victorious Prince Charming, and Maggie Tool winged her first butterfly flight. And though our tropes of fairyland be mixed with those of entomology, they shall not spill one drop of ambrosia from the rose-crowned melody of Maggie's one perfect night. The girls besieged her for introductions to her Ello. The cloverleaf young men, after 2 years of blindness, suddenly perceived charms in Miss Tool. They flexed their compelling muscles before her, and bespoke her for the dance. Thus she scored. But to Terry O'Sullivan the honors of the evening fell thick and fast. He shook his curls. He smiled and went easily through the seven motions for acquiring grace in your own room before an open window 10 minutes each day. He danced like a fawn. He introduced manner and style and atmosphere. His words came trippingly upon his tongue, and he waltzed twice in succession with the paper box girl that Dempsey Donovan brought. Dempsey was the leader of the association. He wore a dress suit, and could chin the bar twice with one hand. He was one of Ig Mike O'Sullivan's lieutenants, and was never troubled by trouble. No cop dared to arrest him. Whenever he broke a Pushkirt man's head, or shot a member of the Heinrich B. Sweeney Outing and Literary Association in the kneecap, an officer would drop around and say, "The captain like to see ye a few minutes round to the office, when ye have time, Dempsey, me boy." But there would be sundry gentlemen there with large gold fob chains and black cigars, and somebody would tell a funny story, and then Dempsey would go back and work half an hour with the 6-pound dumbbells. So, doing a tightrope act on a wire stretched across Niagara was a safe terpsichorean performance compared with waltzing twice with Dempsey Donovan's paper box girl. At 10 o'clock the jolly round face of Ig Mike O'Sullivan shone at the door for 5 minutes upon the scene. He always looked in for 5 minutes, smiled at the girls and handed out real perfectos to the delighted boys. Dempsey Donovan was at his elbow instantly, talking rapidly. Ig Mike looked carefully at the dancers, smiled, shook his head and departed. The music stopped. The dancers scattered to the chairs along the walls. Terry O'Sullivan, with his entrancing bow, relinquished the pretty girl in blue to her partner, and started back to find Maggie. Dempsey intercepted him in the middle of the floor. Some fine instinct that Rome must have bequeathed to us caused nearly everyone to turn and look at them. There was a subtle feeling that two gladiators had met in the arena. Two or three give and takes with tight coat sleeves drew near. "One moment, Mr. O'Sullivan," said Dempsey. "Hope you're enjoying yourself. Where did you say you live?" The two gladiators were well matched. Dempsey had, perhaps, 10 pounds of weight to give away. B. O'Sullivan at breadth with quickness. Dempsey at a glacial eye, a dominating slit of a mouth, an indestructible jaw, a complexion like a bell's and the coolness of a champion. The visitor showed more fire in his contempt, and less control over his conspicuous sneer. They were enemies by the law written, when the rocks were molten. They were each too splendid, too mighty, too incomparable to divide preeminence. One only must survive. I live on grand, said O'Sullivan, insolently, and no trouble to find me at home. Where do you live? Dempsey ignored the question. You say your name's O'Sullivan, he went on. L. Big Mike says he never saw you before. Lots of things he never saw, said the favorite of the hop. As a rule, went on Dempsey, huskily sweet, O'Sullivan's in this district know one another. You escorted one of our lady members here, and we want chance to make good. If you've got a family tree, let's see a few historical O'Sullivan buds come out on it. Or do you want us to dig it out of you by the roots? Suppose you mind your own business, suggested O'Sullivan, blandly. Dempsey's eye brightened. He held up an inspired forefinger, as though a brilliant idea had struck him. I've got it now, he said cordially. T was just a little mistake. You ain't no O'Sullivan. You are a ring-tailed monkey. Excuse us for not recognizing you at first. O'Sullivan's eye flashed. He made a quick movement, but Andy Geoghan was ready, and caught his arm. Dempsey nodded at Andy and William McMahon, the secretary of the club, and walked rapidly toward a door at the rear of the hall. Two other members of the Give and Take Association swiftly joined the little group. Terry O'Sullivan was now in the hands of the Board of Rules and Social Referees. They spoke to him briefly and softly, and conducted him out through the same door at the rear. This movement on the part of the Cloverleaf members requires a word of elucidation. Back of the association hall was a smaller room rented by the club. In this room, personal difficulties that arose on the ballroom floor were settled, man to man, with the weapons of nature, under the supervision of the board. No lady could say that as he had witnessed a fight at a clover leaf hop in several years. Its gentlemen members guaranteed that. So easily and smoothly had Dempsey and the board done their preliminary work that many in the hall had not noticed the checking of the fascinating O'Sullivan's social triumph. Among these was Maggie. She looked about for her escort. Smoke up, said Rose Cassidy. Ask you on? Demps Donovan picked a scrap with your Lizzie boy, and they waltzed out to the slaughter room with him. How's my hair look done up this way, Mag? Maggie laid a hand on the bosom of her cheesecloth waist. Gone to fight with Dempsey, she said, breathlessly. Hey, I've got to be stopped. Dempsey Donovan can't fight him. Why, he'll kill him. Ah, what do you care? Said Rosa. Aren't some of 'em fight every hop? But Maggie was off, darting her zigzag way through the maze of dancers. She burst through the rear door into the dark hall, and then threw her solid shoulder against the door of the room of single combat. It gave way, and in the instant that she entered her eye caught the scene the board standing about with open watches. Dempsey Donovan in his shirt sleeves dancing, light-footed, with the wary grace of the modern pugilist, within easy reach of his adversary, Terry O'Sullivan standing with arms folded, and a murderous look in his dark eyes. And without slacking the speed of her entrance she leaped forward with a scream leaped in time to catch and hang upon the arm of O'Sullivan, that was suddenly uplifted, and to whisk from it the long, bright stiletto that he had drawn from his bosom. The knife fell and rang upon the floor. Cold steel drawn in the rooms of the Give and Take Association. Such a thing had never happened before. Everyone stood motionless for a minute. Andy Geoghan kicked the stiletto with the toe of his shoe curiously, like an antiquarian who has come upon some ancient weapon unknown to his learning. And then O'Sullivan hissed something unintelligible between his teeth. Dempsey and the board exchanged looks. And then Dempsey looked at O'Sullivan without anger, as one looks at a stray dog, and nodded his head in the direction of the door. The back stairs, Giuseppe, he said, briefly. O-M-E-B-O-D-Y apostrophe 11 pitch your hat down after you. Maggie walked up to Dempsey Donovan. There was a brilliant spot of red in her cheeks, down which slow tears were running. But she looked him bravely in the eye. I knew it, Dempsey, she said, as her eyes grew dull even in their tears. Knew he was a guinea. His name's Tony Spinelli. I hurried in when they told me you and him was scrap pin. Them guineas always carries knives. But you don't understand, Dempsey. I never had a fellow in my life. I got tired of coming with Anna and Jimmy every night, so I fixed it with him to call himself O'Sullivan, and brought him along. I knew there'd be nothing doing for him if he came as a Dago. I guess I'll resign from the club now. Dempsey turned to Andy Geoghegan. Chuck that cheese slicer out of the window, he said, and tell him inside that Mr. O'Sullivan has had a telephone message to go down to Tammany Hall. And then he turned back to Maggie. Say, Mag, he said, I'll see you home. And how about next Saturday night? Will you come to the hop with me if I call around for you? It was remarkable how quickly Maggie's eyes could change from dull to a shining brown. With you, Dempsey, she stammered. A will a duck swim? Man about town, there were two or three things that I wanted to know. I do not care about a mystery, so I began to inquire. It took me 2 weeks to find out what women carry in dress suitcases, and then I began to ask why a mattress is made in two pieces. The serious query was at first received with suspicion, because it sounded like a conundrum. I was at last assured that its double form of construction was designed to make lighter the burden of woman who makes up beds. I was so foolish as to persist, begging to know why, then, they were not made in two equal pieces, whereupon I was shunned. The third draft that I craved from the fount of knowledge was enlightenment concerning the character known as a man about town. He was more vague in my mind than a type should be. We must have a concrete idea of anything, even if it be an imaginary idea, before we can comprehend it. Now, I have a mental picture of John Doe that is as clear as a steel engraving. His eyes are weak blue. He wears a brown vest and a shiny black serge coat. He stands always in the sunshine chewing something, and he keeps half shutting his pocket knife and opening it again with his thumb. And, if the man higher up is ever found, take my assurance for it, he will be a large, pale man with blue wristlets showing under his cuffs, and he will be sitting to have his shoes polished within sound of a bowling alley, and there will be somewhere about him turquoises. But the canvas of my imagination, when it came to limning the man about town, was blank. I fancied that he bade a detachable sneer like the smile of the Cheshire Cat and attached cuffs, and that was all. Whereupon I asked a newspaper reporter about him. Why, said he, a man about town something between a rounder and a clubman. He isn't exactly well, he fits in between Mrs. Fish's receptions and private boxing bouts. He doesn't belong either to the Lotos Club, or to the Jerry McGeoghegan Galvanized Iron Workers Apprentices Left Hook Chowder Association. I don't exactly know how to describe him to you. You will see him everywhere there's anything doing. Yes, I suppose he's a type. Dress clothes every evening, knows the ropes, calls every policeman and waiter in town by their first names. No, he never travels with the hydrogen derivatives. You generally see him alone, or with another man. My friend the reporter left me, and I wandered further afield. By this time the 3126 electric lights on the Rialto were alight. People passed, but they held me not. Papian eyes rayed upon me, and left me unscathed. Diners, hamgingers, shopgirls, confidence men, panhandlers, actors, highwaymen, millionaires and outlanders hurried, skipped, strolled, sneaked, swaggered, and scurried by me, but I took no note of them. I knew them all. I had read their hearts. They had served. I wanted my man about town. He was a type, and to drop him would be an error, a typograph, but no, let us continue. Let us continue with a moral digression. To see a family reading the Sunday paper gratifies. The sections have been separated. Papa is earnestly scanning the page that pictures the young lady exercising before an open window and bending, but there. Mama is interested in trying to guess the missing letters in the word N-W-E-O-K. The oldest girls are eagerly perusing the financial reports, for a certain young man remarked last Sunday night that he had taken a flyer in Q-X. And Z. Willie, the 18-year-old son, who attends the New York Public School, is absorbed in the weekly article describing how to make over an old skirt, for he hopes to take a prize in sewing on graduation day. Grandma's holding to the comic supplement with a 2 hours grip, and little Toddy, the baby, is rocking along the best she can with the real estate transfers. This view is intended to be reassuring, for it is desirable that a few lines of this story be skipped, for it introduces strong drink. I went into a cafe too, and while it was being mixed I asked the man who grabs up your hot scotch spoon, as soon as you lay it down, what he understood by the term, epithet, description, designation, characterization, or appellation, viz. :: A and about town. Why, said he, carefully, it means a fly guy that's wise to the all-night pushy. It's a hot sport that you can't bump to the rail anywhere between the Flatiron Sea. I guess that's about what it means. I thanked him and departed. On the sidewalk, a Salvation lassie shook her contribution receptacle gently against my waistcoat pocket. Would you mind telling me, I asked her, if you ever meet with a character commonly denominated as a man about town during your daily wanderings? I think I know whom you mean, she answered, with a gentle smile. We see them in the same places night after night. They are the devil's bodyguard, and if the soldiers of any army are as faithful as they are, their commanders are well served. We go among them. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.